You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, capital punishment has been on the decline in the United States in recent years, but our guest says it should still be a part of our criminal justice system. Now, after a year of decline for Wisconsin's frac sand mining industry, a national analyst says the downturn is likely to continue in 2020. Wisconsin is rich in a type of silica sand known as Northern White. It's used by companies drilling for oil and natural gas, especially in western Texas. But it's a long way to ship sand, so companies down there have been turning to a local kind of sand and seeing how it does the job. Rich Kramer is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Eau Claire, which is located near a bunch of frac sand mining sites. He's been following the industry for years now. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be back.
Before we dig into some of the history here, tell us more about this projection for 2020. What could this once big business see in Wisconsin?
Well, the person I spoke with is one of the vice presidents of Rystad Energy, and they're a firm that looks at not just the frac sand market, but all realms involved with drilling for oil and natural gas. So they're tracking things, you know, how many oil rigs are in across the country are pumping, or how many have been drilled but aren't completed. And they also look at proppant, which is the technical term for stuff you pump down the hole to help hold open the cracks in the rock that holds the oil. And most of that is sand. So for 2019, they tell me that the drilling activity is going to be decreasing a bit, like 5 to 8%. So the demand for sand is going to be pretty much the same, which is to say down from, say, 2014, 2015 levels. And what's changed, though, what seems to be more important to Wisconsin companies that are drilling or that are mining frac sand is that the preference of what kind of sand works for oil drillers has changed. So down in Texas, there's this area called the Permian Basin, West Texas, and that's where most of the oil drilling activity is happening. And companies, starting in 2017, but it really changed in 2018, realized that they could just use local sand that they just scoop up from dunes on the ground and get a lot of the same impact that they would by paying for the higher quality sand from Wisconsin, and thereby saving $50 to $60 a ton for shipping it from Wisconsin to Texas. So that's been the big shift, and that's kind of the main issue, I think, for the companies in Wisconsin.
Right. When you were reporting on this as a booming industry, Rich, the idea was, in a lot of people in the industry said, this Northern White silica sand we have here in Wisconsin, this is the good stuff. You can't really do fracking in a lot of places without sand of this quality, and it sounds like that conventional wisdom has been changing.
Yeah, and what's really been remarkable in my 8 years, I guess, covering this this industry, the hydraulic fracturing, but also the proppant market, is that, you know, Wisconsin sand was it. You know, leading up to 2015, 2014 was the high point, but it was all about Wisconsin sand because it had the highest crush strength. It was very uniform. It was just the bee's knees for these oil companies, but they've learned that if you use a lot more of the cheaper, finer sand, you get similar results, and it's just not as necessary. That said, Wisconsin sand is still valued, and even in Texas, they use a percentage of it. Generally, when the oil companies are drilling very deep, where there's high pressures, they do rely on it, or they'll mix some Wisconsin sand with other types. And also, Wisconsin sand is still serving markets in North Dakota, also the Marcellus Shale, which is like the New York, Pennsylvania area where they're drilling for natural gas. So it does have markets, but it's just a fraction of what it used to be. Everybody used to use Wisconsin sand, and now it's really been marginalized by this local sand down in the Texas, Oklahoma area.
Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter in Eau Claire. We're looking at frac sand, once a boom industry in Wisconsin, now leveling off and declining. Rich, some businesses, at least one business, has already declared bankruptcy over the last year or so. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah, the market is starting to contract. I mean, this has been happening since 2015, 2016. So that's when oil prices started to decline. In 2014, oil was up near $100 a barrel. And since 2016, oil prices have kind of hovered around the $50 to $70 mark. And when that happened, basically everybody had to cut costs. And one way you do that is just get the cheapest product you can. And that's when the transportation costs really became an issue for these companies. Now, the sand mining company in Wisconsin, Superior Silica Sands, that went bankrupt, declared bankruptcy last July. One of the reasons is that they used a lot of trucking. They would mine the sand, then they would truck it to a place where they washed the sand, then they truck it again to the place where they'd put it on the rail cars. That's very expensive. That's the kind of business model that doesn't seem to work unless oil prices are high. So what I've been told is the companies that will do best in this new reality are companies that build right on a rail line. You know, they have the mine, the wash plant, and everything connected by either conveyor belts or slurry pipes, so you don't have to pay a trucking company to move it. It's all about cutting costs, and I'm told that those larger producers that have everything located in one spot on a rail line will probably be the ones that survive.
When a frac sand mine is shut down, whether because its company goes bankrupt or that particular site isn't profitable, what happens? What happens to the land then?
That's a good question. We're kind of learning as we go. So in theory, Wisconsin, before a company even gets a permit to mine, there's something called NR 135, which is, and I hope that's the right number, but basically it's the mine reclamation law. So in Wisconsin, if you want to dig up a pit and be a frac sand producer, you have to prove, you have to show how you're going to fill it in and reclaim the land. But also, part of that is you have to set money aside. Whatever the county determines is the correct amount. Generally, it's in the millions. So you have to set this money aside in bonds. And that money is there. So if you go bankrupt, the county will take that money and reclaim the site. So in Chippewa County, the interesting development is that the county asked for additional money from this Superior Silica Sands, but they were already, then they declared bankruptcy. They never put up this additional $1.6 million. They already have some set aside, but the county said that it wasn't enough. Now they're fighting in court during this bankruptcy proceeding to try to get that money. And the other thing that's a big question mark is there's an insurance company that is holding all of the bonds for Chippewa County for that mine reclamation. That company says that the frac sand producer is in default. So what I'm not sure on yet is if that means that the entire bond amount is, may not be paid. That's a big question that will get fleshed out here. But it's too soon to say what will happen with that. But so in theory, there should be money for all of these mines to be reclaimed. But in reality, it's a big question.
That's a big question we'll be watching over the next year. Rich, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. We talked to him about Wisconsin's struggling frac sand mining industry. Analysts say a decline in oil drilling and a lower demand for the northern white sand could put more operations out of business. Coming up, a Milwaukee-area chapel built by one of the state's famous architects is getting torn down. We'll talk with a historian about the church and the nuns who served there. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Milwaukee is losing what one historian calls the prettiest church you never saw. We'll talk to him about the story of the St. Francis Convent Chapel in just a bit. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Jenny Peek answering a Why Wisconsin question about how county roads get their names.
If you've taken a drive on one of Wisconsin's iconic scenic roads, chances are you've noticed a bit of alphabet soup.
I'm Stephanie Elkins, and for many years lived on a retired dairy farm in Greene County that was near the intersection of J and C, and we had to take County H out of New Galeras to get there, and on the way to work, I would take County J to County G.
I'm Dean Collenbeck. I grew up on County Highway D in Barron County, 21-mile stretch of road that starts at the intersection with County P and ending at County SS on the west side of Chautauqua.
My name is Jana Rose Schleiss. County Highway BB, two Bs, is near where I grew up. People call it double B. I am one of those people. It actually splits Kewaunee and Manitowoc County.
And trying to tell people about this who are not from the area. Yeah, okay, so look for County J, and it's not the same J that's in the other county. It's a different J. And watch for County A, and there's a dog leg, and, you know, it can be very complicated.
So is there any rhyme or reason to how these highways got their names? Shelley from Marshall wanted to know. She asked, why are Wisconsin's county roads labeled with letters instead of numbers? So we reached out to Daniel Federle, executive director of the Wisconsin County Highway Association, to find out.
It's good to start off with a little background. We have state highways that are under state jurisdiction, and we have county highways that are under each of the individual counties, 72 counties in the state. The numbering and lettering came about out of some legislation that happened over 100 years ago now. That system was first set up in 1917, and the Wisconsin County Highway Association was initially formed in 1911. It is credited as being the oldest such association in the nation.
That makes sense, but what about those highway names?
To speak directly to your question, it was designated that it should be signed, marked, and maintained. Previous to that, roads in the nation were not ever really marked. They just happened to be wherever they were. But after the Highway Commission began looking at it, they adopted, for the first time ever in the nation, the system of numbered highways for the state and lettered highways for the county. You'll find virtually every county, you know, certain letters that are the, I guess, for lack of a better term, the more popular. I can't say every county has a County Trunk Highway B, for example, or a County Highway N, but you will find that the vast majority of the counties will have the same ones because we only have the 26 letters to work with. As you can imagine, over the last 100-plus years, as the county gained more roads and took over certain roads and things of that nature, they used up all the letters of the alphabet. And so subsequently, then, once they've used them up, they would go to the double, TT, double S, things of that nature. And then after that, they would start doing variations thereof, you know, county CE or something of that nature. That seems like a simple question, but as you can see, there's a great deal of history. I think certainly we at the Wisconsin County Highway Association are proud of that history because we've been a leader in the nation for forever.
I remember years ago, there's a place we used to go, just a couple miles out of town.
That was Daniel Federle of the Wisconsin County Highway Association talking about the state's lettered highway names. And this story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Jenny Peek.
Now, one of the most historic chapels in the Milwaukee area is in the process of being taken down. The St. Francis Convent Chapel was built more than 120 years ago by one of the state's most famous church architects, and its story is tied to the history of the Lake Franciscan nuns who called it home. John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian whose books include The Making of Milwaukee. He recently wrote about the St. Francis Chapel for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be here, Rob.
Well, you called this chapel in your piece the prettiest church you never saw. You did get to see it once. Can you paint us a picture of it before we go into the history?
It was certainly very Gothic, and the architect was a man named Erhard Brielmeier, who's most famous for the Basilica of St. Joseph out in the south side, which is this probably the biggest church in Wisconsin, certainly among them. It's this wonderful kind of scaled-down version of St. Peter's in Rome. And he designed a Gothic church and attached it to the mother house, finished that back in 1895. So it was not a traditional church, no, that would have mass for the general community in a neighborhood. It was for the nuns, you know, which is why it was the chapel very few people saw. But I was in there, and it was gorgeous. You know, it was just spectacular windows. They were imported from Innsbruck, Austria, the Tyrolean Art Glass Studio, which was just a masterful practitioner of stained and painted glass. So it's sad to see it go.
And it was connected to the Lake Franciscan nuns. Can you talk about their early history in Milwaukee?
The Lake Franciscans are a Franciscan order who began to arrive here back in 1849 when the city of Milwaukee was just 3 years old. And they intended to minister to all the German immigrants who were so abundant here in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin. And they came into the orbit of St. Francis Seminary. And the nuns were, the sisters were asked to bake bread and make bricks for the seminary.
So some wasn't quite what they had in mind, right?
Not quite. So some of the foundresses, it was called the tertiary order. It was lay, but not ordained. But it's both men and women. The guys left, and the women formed an order of their own in 1853, the first Franciscan order in America. The others were imported from Europe. And they did certainly support the seminary at the same time. They took on ministries ranging from St. Emilion's Orphanage to St. John's School for the Deaf. You know, so they had a very, very large role to play in education.
And they're connected in large part, you write, at least at some stages, to Milwaukee's German-American population.
They were all German. They were all from Bavaria. And it took them a while before they assimilated enough to take English-speaking novices or candidates. And that was true for all the orders, you know, the Polish, the German, Italian, and others. You know, it took a while to Americanize them. They founded Cardinal Stritch College. You know, so that's an order, sister Order of St. Francis institution as well.
So why now in 2020 are we losing the chapel? Other parts of the church buildings had come down already, it sounds like.
They have, and basically it's a reflection of the decline of religious vocations in the Catholic Church in particular, but more generally in America. You know, poverty, chastity, and obedience, you know, these are not something that, you know, it's always been hard, and it's a much harder sell in 2020 than it was in any other time. So the order, the Lake Franciscans, who were at one time up to nearly 1,000 sisters, is down to about 158, and I think their average age is 82. So they're, you know, this is not a growth proposition. So what they've done is they tore down the old St. Mary's Academy, which for many years was a center for the nonprofits, and they turned that into essentially offices for the order and also a care facility for the aging nuns. And that will, in time, as they age out and kind of move on to their own rewards, will become a facility for the general public. So it's kind of, in some ways, an exit strategy, and obviously quite expensive to put up new buildings. So there was an attempt, at least hopes, that they could reserve the chapel. But when they tore down the mother house, that exposed the south wall, and putting a new entrance in would have been a rather ambitious project. So it was... I talked to the sisters. And I see them on the grounds there. We live not too far away in the Bayview neighborhood, and there's just you know, kind of it's heartbreaking. You know, it's just to lose that kind of iconic, that touchstone of the past and identity. You know, for the order, certainly been very painful.
And in your piece about the chapel, you also wrote about the loss of a person with a deep connection to the chapel and an unusual connection to you. It turned out one of the sisters. Can you tell that story?
That's right. Probably the best-known sister from the order is Sister Thomasita, Thomasita Fessler, who was a very well-known artist back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and then later. She was raised in the house in which we live in Bayview on Delaware Avenue. Her younger sister, Annette, was also a member of the Order of St. Francis, the Lake Franciscans. So something we had not known, and a relative who lives down the street said, you know, really, having a sister Annette over would be kind of fun. You know, she'd enjoy it, and you'd probably enjoy it, too. So she died just this last fall, and we had her over for we gave her some Christmas cookies and showed her the tree, and the best story she told, she was born in this house, and I'm talking to you from the house in which she was raised, but the best story she told was She walked to St. Mary's Academy, which was a Catholic girls' school on the lakefront that is on the site of the present convent, the brand-new convent. And when she joined the order, and this is back in the days with those really heavy habits, you know, so it gets to be 80, 90 degrees, and she said when she was a girl, she would go down in hot weather to swim on Bayview Beach every day in the summertime, you know, so it's kind of free and easy as a young girl. And then when she was a nun, she would look out the window at the same beach and be unable to go there. Oh. And she said that was such a penance.
That's one way to look at it. Now, the loss of this chapel, is this something you think we'll see with more churches and chapels around the state in the future?
Oh, absolutely. No, this is it's a rare case in that it's a religious orders building. But as these older buildings become harder to maintain, and you know, we have an older house here in 1907, and it, you know, it takes a lot to keep these things up. And as neighborhoods change, as congregations, you know, move elsewhere, you know, certainly there has been a lot of attrition among Wisconsin religious buildings, and it will certainly continue. That's what makes the success stories, you know, all the more heartening. And probably the most famous one, or the most notable one, is the Brielmeier project, which is St. Joseph's Basilica. Now that's been, you know, brought back to its original glory. That's a great success story. So there is, you know, I think I'm not sure what the ultimate balance will be, but there have been gains or certainly preservations that have balanced the losses.
And John, briefly, we've talked to you before about the big picture, the history of Milwaukee. We see, you've got this long view where you see institutions like this rise and fall. It's part of life in a city in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. No, cities live and breathe. Communities live and breathe. So I think certainly I'm a preservationist. I think we need to make sure that the built environment around us, the one that have been handed down by our ancestors, is vital to preserve that. At the same time, you cannot enclose any building or neighborhood in amber. You know, they need to breathe. You know, they need to kind of respond to the outside world. And you know, that certainly you see that. You know, the downside of that obviously is that you know, we lose buildings. But at the same time, you know, life is change.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee historian. His books include The Making of Milwaukee. He joined us for a look at the city's St. Francis Convent Chapel just outside of Milwaukee, completed in 1895, being torn down this year. Coming up, our guest makes the case for capital punishment in the American legal system. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent welcomes Wisconsin's School Superintendent of the Year from Fall Creek for a look at the opportunities and challenges facing schools around Wisconsin. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, executions, new death sentences, and the number of inmates sitting on death row in states have all been declining in recent years. That's according to information from the Death Penalty Information Center and the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. The former organization found that last year, 22 inmates were put to death in 2019. That's down from 25 the previous year and 52 a decade ago. That was the fifth straight year with fewer than 30 executions. Last month on Central Time, we talked to Robert Dunham from the Death Penalty Information Center about the state of capital punishment in the U.S. He made the case against the death penalty. Now, for another perspective, we have Kent Scheidegger with us. He's legal director for the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. Kent, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the argument for capital punishment, what do you make of the decline in those numbers of new sentences and executions in recent years?
I'd say there are two main factors in that. One is simply the decline in the number of murders. The number of murders per capita is down about half from the peak. And then on top of that, there is greater selectivity among both prosecutors and juries in selecting which murderers are going to be sentenced to death. So I think those two in combination have brought it down. Another factor is we have Illinois, which is a relatively large state, that abolished the death penalty. Other than that, the states that have abolished it have been fairly small. So,
and you,
that's the main factor.
You and your organization make the case that we should keep capital punishment as one potential sentence in our criminal justice system. Yes. For the basics, why do you make that case?
Well, the first case, and this is just for the very worst murders, is simple justice. The very first capital case I ever worked on involved a man who was in prison for life for murder, and from within prison arranged the murder of the witnesses to his first murder. So our choices of punishment in that case are either death or no punishment at all, because you can't do consecutive life sentences. We only get one life. We also have cases of serial rape, murder, torture. The case of Lawrence Bittaker, for example, raped, murdered, and tortured five teenage girls. A life sentence was simply inadequate for him, and it's a travesty that he was able to live out his whole life in prison.
One of the most common arguments against the death penalty is, even if it's rare that we get it wrong, the risk of getting it wrong and having this irrevocable punishment that we can't make up in any way, that's a strong case against it. People say, what do you say to that concern that we might execute the wrong people?
Well, that would be getting it wrong not only at trial, but all the way through the review process. And I would say that is extremely rare to non-existent.
And
capital cases are reviewed far more extensively than non-capital cases. Capital defendants have resources far beyond what are given to those sentenced to life in prison. And I would say if you had an innocent person who was wrongly convicted of murder, the chances of him dying in prison are much greater if he's sentenced to life in prison than it is if he's sentenced to death.
Yeah, talk about the time it takes to go through a capital case.
It takes way too long. And every case should have a thorough review once on direct appeal and then a second time in a proceeding where additional evidence can be introduced. The problem is we review these cases again and again and again, and not primarily for issues that have anything whatever to do with guilt or innocence. The repeated reviews are primarily over issues only on the sentencing phase. And so we're wasting a lot of time and a lot of resources on issues that have nothing to do with whether the person actually committed the crime.
We're talking about capital punishment with Kent Scheidegger from the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. He says we should keep it in our criminal justice toolkit. Kent, I want to give a listen to Robert Dunham from the Death Penalty Information Center. He worries about how capital punishment is applied. Here's a listen.
And the fact that the death penalty appears to continue to be arbitrarily, discriminatorily, and almost randomly applied have led to a decreased public appetite for capital punishment and an American public that is less trusting of states to carry it out properly.
Let's get to the first part of that statement, the idea that the death penalty is arbitrarily, discriminatorily, and he says almost randomly applied. What do you say to that?
Discriminatorily is not correct. That the idea that the death penalty is imposed more often on minority defendants than on white defendants for comparable crimes has been refuted by studies time and time again, including by the other side's own studies. The almost randomly part is just preposterous. These cases are reviewed through multiple layers, very carefully, considering all the facts, and it's only the worst cases that make it to the death penalty.
Is it fair to say, though, that even in places with the death penalty, there might be differences from one, say, prosecutor to another in how likely they are to seek the death penalty?
Well, I wouldn't say one prosecutor. I mean, the jurisdictions do have review boards within the office. So it's not one person deciding, yes, I'm going to go for death or no, I'm not. There are differences between jurisdictions. And that's part of the decentralized system of government that we have in the United States. We decentralize decisions. We don't make one decision for the whole country. We have decisions by states. And then some of our officials, including prosecutors, are typically elected by county. And so there is some degree of judgment there. And the people of the county make that choice to elect that person to have the judgment executed or that discretion exercised in a certain way. That's the system of local democracy working as designed.
And then that second part of the statement, he talked about an American public less trusting of states to carry out the death penalty properly and a decreased public appetite for capital punishment. At least some Gallup polling seems to bear that out over time, less support for capital punishment. Why do you see that happening?
Well, the main factor, if you take the question that Gallup has been asking since the 30s, which is not a good question, but it's useful for determining trends, you see that support for capital punishment rises and falls almost directly with the rate of violent crime. It's a very strong correlation. But the poll that the other side cites the most is an extremely badly worded poll question. And the results in death penalty polls vary dramatically depending on how the question is worded. So if you don't mind, I'd like to actually read the question.
Sure.
Because it matters. Okay, here's the question that they cite. If you could choose between the following two approaches, which do you think is the better penalty? Definite article, singular. For murder, the death penalty or life imprisonment with absolutely no possibility of parole. As strong a supporter of the death penalty as I am, if I had to answer that question, I would say life in prison myself. Because that question is asking for one penalty for all murders. But that's not the real public policy question. That's not the question to be decided. The question is whether we abolish the death penalty, which we apply to the worst murders. A poll by Quinnipiac found that if you ask that question, there is a 2-to-1 margin for keeping it rather than abolishing it. Only 31% said abolish, 64% said no, do not abolish the death penalty.
As you mentioned, a lot of this is done state by state. There has been talk from Attorney General Barr about bringing back the federal, actually using the federal death penalty. Can you talk about how the federal system works as compared to what happens state by state?
Well, the federal death penalty does have a single prosecutor for the entire country. And so the Attorney General does make that decision on a nationwide basis for those cases that are within the federal jurisdiction. Now, most murders are not. Most murders are state, and the feds usually get involved if there's some other connection, terrorism, drug dealing, things like that, kidnapping across state lines. So for that system, the Attorney General makes the decision, and there is only one set of courts it goes through. It goes through the federal courts only. So it's a little bit different situation than you have with states, but it's basically the same criteria for whether a person is actually sentenced to death or not that a jury is instructed to use.
As you mentioned, you wouldn't support, it sounds like, the death penalty for all murder cases. Do you have a sense of, I guess, the percentage? What is the worst of the worst case where capital punishment might be appropriate?
It's a handful of percent at the top. I wouldn't try to put a number, a precise number on it, but it's a relatively small fraction. Most killings are impulsive, and those in states that divide murder into degrees, second-degree murder is not a capital offense at all. You can't get the death penalty for it. And so you have the majority of cases that wouldn't even be eligible for capital punishment.
We're talking to Kent Scheidegger, legal director for the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation, looking at capital punishment in the United States. He says it should be an option in our criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you come down on capital punishment? Do you agree with Wisconsin? Currently, it does not have the death penalty. Should it, or is it right that it doesn't? What do you want to see from the federal government? What do you think of the push by Attorney General Barr to reinstate it at the federal level? And what questions do you have for our guest about him and his organization's support of the death penalty? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the death penalty in the United States. Kent Scheidegger is with us of the pro-capital punishment group Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. They say it should be an option, one potential punishment in our criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Wisconsin not having the death penalty, not having capital punishment here in the state? Would you like to see it brought back here at the state level? Do you think it's an effective deterrent? How about at the federal level? And what questions do you have for our guest? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Chris starts us off in Middleton. Chris, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you want to bring up, Chris?
So when I was in middle school, this is a number of years ago, they had us do reports and stuff like that. I did a report on the death penalty. Granted, this is from a middle schooler's point of view. but I found that, at least the data I found, suggested that the death penalty is significantly more cost due to appeals and court prices to the state versus life in prison. I was curious if that trends, or like if that's true or even.
Chris, thanks for the call. Kent, the cost of capital punishment versus life in prison.
Well, that's hotly disputed and extremely difficult to determine. California once asked a consultant to do that, and they came back with the answer that that can't be done with anything like the budget you have for the study. So most of these simplistic studies should be taken with a grain of salt. I think the death penalty does presently cost a lot more than it needs to, for the reason I mentioned earlier. Repeated appeals on issues having nothing to do with guilt. I think if we give everybody one full round of appeals for both guilt and penalty, and then focus all further reviews entirely on guilt, it would go a lot faster, and it would cost a lot less. So I don't think costing less is a reason to choose death rather than life in prison, but I think the claim that it costs vastly more as a reason to get rid of it is overstated.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, I want to express my opinion, then ask a question. So when I went to school, the Ten Commandments said, thou shalt not kill. And then when I learned about Jesus, Jesus said, the reason why we don't kill is because it, by killing someone else, it kills part of us because we're supposed to be close to God. So my question is philosophical in the sense that, how does a society justify taking a life when we have a constitution that says we have a right to life? Is it constitutional? Is the death penalty constitutional?
Jeff, thanks for the call. I think two different questions there I'm hearing. Kent, a moral objection, first of all. Can you talk about that?
Well, the theological stuff is not really my field, but the thou shalt not kill comes from the King James translation of the Bible, which is a great work of the golden age of English literature, but as translation, it has a lot of problems. And the translation that I see in the modern versions is always do not commit murder. And I agree, do not commit murder. But not all killings are murder. Self-defense is not murder. Killing the enemy in war is not murder. And a properly executed death sentence is not murder. And the same book of the Bible that has that passage in it also prescribes the death penalty for a surprising number of offenses. So I don't think you can make the biblical claim if that's what you're oriented toward.
And then Jeff raised the constitutional issue he raised. People have argued that the death penalty constitutes cruel and unusual punishment.
All right. No, I think that's fairly clear that it does not. The Supreme Court decided it does not in 1976. That's highly unlikely to be reversed in the foreseeable future. And if you look at the original meaning of the words cruel and unusual, the word unusual meant not in accordance with the usages of the law. So a penalty that was in widespread use at the time the Constitution and the Eighth Amendment were adopted and has been the law in most states ever since, it cannot be unusual in that sense.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about capital punishment. Kent Scheidegger is with us from the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. Back to your calls now. Todd is with us in La Crosse. Todd, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I guess mine was just more of his thoughts on what he thought about capital punishment for habitual offenders, you know, third or fourth drunk drivings or third or fourth dealing with drugs, you know, just, you know, having capital punishment for those offenders if it'll drive down offenses, you know, with them doing that.
Todd, thanks for the call, Kent. So capital punishment potentially for repeat offenders of crimes other than homicide.
Well, two answers. One, the Supreme Court has said it's unconstitutional. No. So that's that. My personal opinion is I agree with the court that it's disproportionate. And even a repeat offense should not be a capital offense if it's not murder or some crime such as treason or espionage. It's an extremely severe crime.
Todd, thanks a lot for that call. We got a message from Dave in Wausau who says, we don't have a justice system with enough integrity. He thinks it's weighted in general toward the prosecution, and he doesn't support the death penalty until that imbalance, as he claims, is balanced back out. What do you think?
No, I think the penalty is weighted in favor of the defendant. The prosecution must make its proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It must get a unanimous jury. And then after that, there are appeals, but only the defendant can appeal. The prosecution cannot appeal errors that run in favor of the defendant. So I think the defendant is amply protected in our system.
I want to get into a couple more issues before we run out of time, Kent. Another concern people have raised is the methods of execution. There was attention to so-called botched executions where the combination of drugs didn't work as planned. What do you make of that concern about capital punishment?
Well, the number of botched executions is actually very small, but it has happened. And the reason it has happened is that the opponents of the death penalty have put pressure on the drug manufacturers to cut off the supply of the optimum drugs needed for the best form of execution. The best way to do it is exactly the way veterinarians euthanize animals, with an overdose of pentobarbital. And when that is done, there have been no botched executions. So I think the opponents have actually caused that problem.
Another issue that comes up is the idea of competency. And this is one of those non-guilt or innocence issues that you may have touched on earlier, the idea that somebody might have committed the heinous act, but we regard them as not able to be competent to stand trial for that. How does that fit into the discussion?
Well, if the person is not competent to stand trial, then he doesn't stand trial. And there are people who have been held for a long time seeking to restore their competency. And sometimes they aren't ever restored and they're, you know, committed civilly instead.
Looking at the future of capital punishment and the politics surrounding it, the trends seem to be states either abolishing it, as New Hampshire recently did, or having official moratoria on it, as some states have done. Do you see things starting to swing back in the other direction?
Not yet, but I think it's certainly possible. We are seeing disturbing indications that crime may be going back up, in part because of misguided policies, not only and not particularly capital punishment, but going soft on crime generally. And we do know that support does go up and down with the crime rate. I would hate to see the crime rate go up, but if it does, I suspect we'll see a pendulum swing back in the other direction.
And as we wrap up, is there a part of the country you're watching this issue on particularly closely right now?
Well, no, I wouldn't say we focus on parts of the country. I mean, our job is primarily to advocate in the courts for the victims of crime and for the law-abiding public, and we take the cases wherever they come.
Kent, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Kent Scheidegger. He's legal director for the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. We talked to him today about his organization's support for capital punishment in the United States at the state and federal levels. They want it to remain as an option in the criminal justice system. That follows a conversation we had last month with the executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, who made the case against capital punishment and pointed out trends that the country was moving away from it. You can always share your thoughts on this and other issues we talk about over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, payday lending businesses could face new regulations here in Wisconsin. That's under a proposed bill with some at least bipartisan support among state lawmakers. We'll get the details from one of the sponsors of that bill and then look at the impact of payday loans in the state. And you can join in with your thoughts and maybe your experiences with short-term loans and payday lending. Exercise can help more than just our physical health. The author of the new book, The Joy of Movement, tells us that getting active can build happiness and hope, too. A little more support for your New Year's resolution if you've made one to get more exercise and be healthier. Plus, Charles Schulz was a longtime presence on the comics page with Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and all the rest of the Peanuts gang. A new book explores his influence on cartoonists, writers, and the rest of us. We'll check out that book, find out what a lot of big names have to say about Charles Schulz and Peanuts, and you can call in to share your thoughts and your memories of the long-running beloved comic strip. That plus a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, former state lawmaker Tim Cullen joins the show with a look at his new book about the closure of the Janesville GM plant and the long-running impact it had on the community. That's tomorrow at 6 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then our guest says America's political scene is not just polarized, it's in a state of high conflict. But she says there is a way out. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.